I think maybe 2 years ago, I thought probably a bit more worry and just worries really, and the idea of making sure you know everyone's in the right place. And ultimately, whether I'm captain or not captain, you want everyone to play well and you want to help them do that. It's probably a limit. I probably stop thinking, oh, well, I can't control everything. So fundamentally, get your role right, play well and lead by that example. And that goes a long way to helping everyone else, and then keeping the messaging quite simple for people really.
Everyone has ambitions. To start their own business, to lose weight, to launch a podcast. But for most of us, those ambitions are still on the to-do list. We'll get round to them one day. But some people overcome procrastination. That thing you'd love to do, they knew the risks, but said screw it and just did it anyway. On the Screw It, Just Do It podcast, I'm on a mission to answer one simple question. How do you get to where you want to be? Joining me are inspirational entrepreneurs, sports stars, entertainers, and authors who took the leap. They became the people they wanted to be. They did what they always wanted to do. In this series of revealing, challenging, and often surprising conversations, they might just help you discover how to do it too.
Alex Gird is a professional record-breaking rugby player for Saracens, where he's been part of numerous English Premiership Championships, won 3 European Cups, been named European Player of the Year, and won 21 England caps. And immortalised on social media and the mainstream press for celebrating Sarri's 3rd European Cup triumph by going out for 3 days in full kit, boots, gum shield and all to celebrate with a Guinness or 33. Whilst his passion for rugby remains undimmed, he's still demonstrating his leadership qualities by captaining Saracens and his versatility by playing both fly half and fullback. By age 34, his thoughts have turned to what life after rugby could look like. During our conversation at Alex's home in North London, with Mini Dashun tucked under his arm instead of a rugby ball, we talk about passion being the fundamental baseline to being successful, how to work hard to get on top of your game, life after rugby and his biggest fear, and dealing with anxiety and stress and putting pressure on yourself. But firstly, we kick things off by asking Alex what his screw it, just do it moment was.
First question, like I said, is exploring how you get to where you want to be. And is there any obvious screw it, just do it moment?
I think deep down, yes. Quite hard to look back, sort of 20 years or so. Always wanted to play sport, love rugby the most. And ultimately, I always believe whatever you have a passion in, you're going to be the best at it. Because you don't see it as hard work. I remember, for me, I love football, probably better at football than I was at rugby when I was younger and other sports, but I had a passion for rugby, which meant I was willing to go out and kick rugby balls and pass rugby balls, you know, in the morning, in the evening, whenever, because it wasn't like, oh, I've got to do that. It was, I love doing it. And the same thing, if you're into art, music, drama, whatever it is, when you have a passion for something, you just will put all your effort in, and you're very, very likely to be a success at that, I think, more successful in that than anything else.
And were you more passionate about rugby than football? Or was it 50-50 at a certain age? Or
I think I was passionate about sport and I love competing and I still am incredibly competitive. And I just think when it's football, I just love trying to win and trying to beat other people. But I always look back a bit and it's slightly different. I never missed a rugby game, but there were football games I did sometimes miss. It was quite often I'd go rugby to then football straight away. And I guess, you know, a lot of my teammates, it meant everything to them for these big games, and their parents, grandparents, uncle, sister, brother would all be watching on the sideline and have their Lucozade support for the game, the bananas. They'd be doing their warm up, and I'd just get flung out of the car by my mum, muddy knees, getting changed in the back of the car, run over there, barely do a warm up and just go and play. Yeah. And I was, you know, being arrogant, I was a good player, and I would then excel and do well, but I would then leave, go home and, you know, not think about it. I think rugby, I probably thought about it a bit more. As I said, I was willing to put more practice and time into it. But it's just difficult because at a younger age, football, particularly in other sports, you can kind of measure yourself. Mm. There's sort of county things, there's clubs. For me, it was Ipswich Town or Cambridge United. There were lots of things to measure yourself against other players. With rugby, it was sort of my local rugby club, Cambridge. And it wasn't like a county or Eastern Counties sort of selection stuff until you're 15 or 16 years old. So you don't quite, you think you're okay, but from playing different schools, but you don't really know outside of the little bubble you're in. No. So yeah, it's quite hard to judge it on that. But yeah, I had a passion for rugby probably more. And that's probably as well, again, on reflection, why I've had longevity in the game, because I do love the sport. Mm. I love being there. I love competing, you know, even training, you know, when it's not too cold or wet or windy, which is rare in England. But, you know, I can keep doing it at an old age because I have that love for the game.
Yeah. And did you, what steps did you do? Did you go straight from school to like academy, professional?
Yeah, I wasn't in the academy before, which is quite rare nowadays, but I left school at 18, did my A-levels, and then I think after my leavers do whatever, or a couple of days after the last day, I was straight into pre-season at Saracens.
Really?
Living in an academy house with three other guys and learning, you know, I remember, never forget it, I had a piece of paper which had scrambled egg, omelette, pasta and chicken, and carbonara, something like that. They were my four staple recipes for basically a year nearly.
Did your mum teach you those or anything?
She didn't teach me, she wrote them down. I had to learn what I got there. And, you know, it was a huge learning curve. And I know that I was very lucky that I had a probably 2-year academy contract, because the first year I wasn't professional enough. I didn't understand what it took to be a professional. I wasn't good enough. I probably thought I'd done England under 18s. So I'm pretty talented and pretty good. You soon realise that every player in professional rugby has done England 18s, under 20s and stuff like that. It's not that impressive. And while the senior players seem like they're not working hard, they put in the hard yards to get to where they are, and you have to work a lot harder as an academy player to get to their level. And I wasn't doing that. I was playing on loan at Cambridge Rugby Club. I was going back and seeing my mates most weekends. I hadn't immersed myself in professional rugby, being a professional at all, really. And the penny probably dropped a bit, probably the back end of that year, maybe the start of the next season. I was like, okay, I went away and trained really hard in the off season, really worked hard, physically grew into my body a bit, got a bit stronger. And I was in with the first team straight away and did a full pre-season with them and started to live up to some of my promise, because I was more professional. I said training harder, doing extras much more after training, like working with the first team players all the time, so you're naturally playing with better players, you upskill. Yeah. And it's sort of the penny had dropped that I have to work pretty hard here and get better, otherwise this chance is gonna leave me. So yeah, it wasn't all plain sailing, that's for sure. And certainly I wasn't first choice at England under 18s, and I'll never forget that, and that drove me on. I was third or fourth choice under 16s. I was even under 19s. I played fullback, not fly half. I always think those kind of memories of not being first choice probably had a good sort of chip on my shoulder. Mm. Always wanted to prove people wrong.
Yeah.
Because I felt I should have been, and my skill set was underrated, and I don't know whether I used that as motivation or I just had it. It was always something that's probably put me in a good place to work a bit harder, to prove people wrong, and showcase that I was very good, basically.
And was there anybody like at the club as you came through who you kind of looked up to and saw the difference in how they were training, how they were looking after themselves?
Yeah, really. I was very lucky. I had Richard Hill was at the club. Now, Saracens, when I first got there, was quite a failing organisation. I can say that now. It wasn't a good organisation. They hadn't won anything. They were close to relegation. The year I arrived, they were, you know, a point away from being relegated. They had all these superstars, and yet they never won anything. And I realise now, looking at it, it was little cliques here, and no one worked hard for each other. There was no togetherness. There was no fight. They'd play well for the odd home game, but away from home, they were poor. And actually, it was an average like squad. Lots of talent, but no. Said no fight, no togetherness, just soft underbelly. And what part of that was, no one was really pushing to be much better. You know, and I say that with not to be nasty to those players, but I don't know how ambitious they were. But the one person who stood out for me, who was part of the England setup at the time under Clive Woodward, who was pushing every single part of recovery, training, nutrition, you know, professionalism, that was Richard Hill. And I can't really remember how it happened, but he was sort of still playing, but going into sort of his last year or so, and he wanted to get into a bit of coaching, but not full-time coaching. So he started doing some mentoring, and he chose me, and I sort of latched onto that. You know, we didn't play the same position at all, but he was invaluable to me, particularly just around good habits, professionalism, how you conduct yourself, just small things like, you know, he wouldn't tell me how I should kick the ball or how I should run the ball back or do that. But he would say, here, were you in the right position beforehand? Did you work hard enough to give yourself the best chance? You know, when you got to this breakdown, could you have done this? You know, in terms of preparation for the game, what can you do? Communication to other players. Instead of you saying, get round the court, use individual names. You know, I can still remember exactly where he said that. It was such an easy point, but so powerful for me to go, ah, oh, Loz, get around the corner, get around the corner, as opposed to, ah, oh, get around the corner. No one, you know, give individual names to people. It was really powerful as a 19-year-old trying to organise games as a fly half. He was brilliant for me, and certainly my game went up like that. I did England 20s that year, had a really good year as a fly half. Organised that, we got to the World Cup final, unfortunately lost, but a lot of my growth was hugely helped by him.
Interesting, isn't it? You look at the kind of cycles of success that different clubs have gone through, and believe it or not, I was at Bath, and we're going back in the 90s, and never got to first team stage. But when I was there, it was Andy Robinson was the 7, John Hall was the 6, Ben Clark was the 8, then he got Steve Ajomo, who just come through, and now his son's like playing for Bath. But like trying to actually break into that back row was just like nigh on impossible. But just being at training, you know, throughout the week and seeing how those guys train, when it was like Richard Hill was like, you know, the scrum half, you've got Jeremy Guscott, people like just being surrounded by that, and then being taken out as like one of the youngsters there at like 18 years old, but taken out after a game for a curry, like with the guys and something, was unbelievable, like education. So it's interesting you saying that.
Yeah, I think, yeah, again, fate or however you look at it, Richard Hill maybe saw something, I don't know, he seems to sell me since, he saw something in me.
Really?
And he thought maybe it needed a bit of refining or certainly some nurturing. And I wasn't lost on me as to how good a player he was, how successful he was, and was just wide-eyed. And every day, every time I could, I'd get the clips up and go with him and show him, and he would help and listen to what he said. And the fact that, it, you know, I can still remember those conversations now, it says a lot about probably the respect I had for him and how good the points were.
Yeah.
It's not to say there weren't other people who were really helpful in different ways, but I think at that kind of pivotal point where I was learning to be a bit more mature, learning what it took, as I said, to be a professional, because I wasn't professional enough and I would have never made it really. I think it had a really profound effect on me at that age, and yeah, I'm very grateful for that.
And at the time, were you ever worried that you might fail, that you might not make the grade? Do you have those thoughts when you're that age, 18, 19?
Yeah, I think self-doubt, insecurities in there throughout, really, not just at that age, even now 34, there are times you question it throughout. I think, yeah, especially that first year, you come in and then you realise, like, geez, I can't do this, and like I'm not really standing out National 2 level, and this is going to be quite hard. But it's amazing when you put a little bit more effort, a bit more time into it, you sort of start working on your craft a lot more, really, that, you know, how much your game can improve and how quickly. And credit to Eddie Jones as well. In the third year, so 2 years, he came in and I thought, you know, he signed me and said, you know, I was a big part of the future. And he made me, you know, pretty much I was out there first and coming in last, training the house down, you know, pretty much the fittest, was, you know, the strongest I'd ever been before that. I was doing more kicking, more passing, more tackling, more everything to try and get a chance. And I didn't get a shot for the first 3 or 4 months, and I was, you know, at the time I was like, what's the point of doing this? I know it was a really good lesson, because I then did get a shot and I didn't get dropped for the rest of the year. And I think the message for me there I took from it was, you do all that work, you upskill yourself, so when the game comes, you've got it in the bank. Yeah. And you don't have to think about it, you've got those skills, so you can just play rugby, and you've prepared yourself so much that you get that chance and you grab it and you don't let go. Yeah. And I think it was a really good lesson for me. I'm not doing that to try and impress Eddie Jones or the other coaches. I'm doing that for my own benefit. So when I, as I say, get a chance, that, you know, I can cruise through that and that I'm ready for it and I can take it. So yeah, it was a great lesson for me, actually. And one that I hadn't appreciated at the time, I was getting frustrated, but actually looking back, it resonated with me quite a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm training for London Marathon at the moment, and I did New York Marathon back in November. And I read David Goggins' book, and in it he talks about like a cookie jar. Whereas when you've done something, you put it in the jar, and it's like tapping into that memory that, you know, when things are tough and you're thinking, how the fuck am I going to do this? You can literally go, I've done this before. It's here, and like bring out and go, boom, there you go.
You've repped it so many times, it becomes, you know, sort of natural, and you know, you do it without even thinking. So yeah, it was interesting at the time. I was thinking, what am I doing this for? But as I said, the chance came, and those skills became second nature and are so important. And they still are to this day. And you know, I still work on them incredibly hard, because you know, you have to. It's not a skill you do once, you say the cookie jar, and you just leave it there for 10 years. You have to keep doing it and keep doing it. And yeah, it was a great lesson.
And you mentioned Ronnie Eddie Jones there. What were your thoughts when you heard that he'd lost the England job?
I was quite surprised. I think surprised they did that this close to the World Cup. Didn't really understand what the difference was between after the Six Nations in 2022, when England hadn't done very well and they'd done a review and said, no, he's going to keep it. I'm not sure what changed then to the end of the autumn, really, because he wins in Australia and then goes back and he has, you know, a couple of bad results, and then it's like he's gone. So I was surprised, but at the same time, I did think Borthwick was the right man to come in if Eddie is to go. And you know, I think he'll do a great job. It's a tough ask with the amount of time he has leading into the World Cup, but I think he'll do a good job. So I think there was a couple of comments. Like everything in that scenario, I was like, they probably aren't going to get really ready. And then you start seeing things from people who are close to Eddie's camp, things being leaked, and you go, hang on a minute, maybe this is going to happen. And Eddie's not stupid at all. He's a shrewd man, and maybe he wanted that to happen towards the end. I don't know, because he's certainly had clearly lined up or back-channeled things with Australia to give himself a chance to go there, and he'll be very good in that role as well. So, you know, credit to him. He's probably got an outcome that he's happy with. The English media, as we know, are particularly hard and difficult to please, and if you get on the back foot with them, then it's sometimes hard to change that momentum.
Yeah, and like you say, really close to the World Cup, but then you get Wales doing the same and then Australia doing the same, and it's like, wow, like, you know, tier one nations doing that.
Yeah, I mean, the Wales one, I guess, was coming a bit, like some bad results and tricky. I don't know Wayne Pivac. I don't know what was going on there, so I can't comment too much on that. But obviously, when they sound out Gatland, he's someone they believe in hugely and has got a proven track record and an exceptional record. I think with Australia as well, it's quite opportunistic. I think they would have kept Dave Rennie to the World Cup, but... Yeah. Thinking that Eddie was available and knowing what he can do in a short space of time with talent, you know, they probably thought it's worth taking that punt.
And Eddie was the one who signed you for Sarah's. What was your relationship like with him through the years, like up and down, like every relationship?
It's quite funny, really, because people are quite surprised by that. Eddie gave me my first shot, really, as a professional, played me week in, week out. He then unfortunately lost his job in Jan or Feb that year, but he played me a lot. He backed me. He demanded a lot from me, was tough on me, as he is with a lot of people, but I responded to that pretty well, really, and thought the fact that he's putting that much time into me is probably a good thing, even though it was hard and demanded a lot, as I said. But yeah, he didn't last too long at Saracens. But he had a profound effect. He gave me a shot, and I'm always grateful for that, really. Our relationship at that point was pretty good. Obviously, when he came to England, I was probably optimistic when he got the job, to be honest. Very wrong on that one. I thought, oh boy, I know, really, that could be quite good for me. And it turned out it wasn't, really. And it comes down to one man's opinion now.
Yeah.
You know, he did a great job with England, and you know, unfortunately, I didn't get much of a shot, and that's disappointing, but I try not to dwell on it too much. I'm sure when I retire, I'll probably feel a bit more aggrieved, maybe, and annoyed about it, but you know, here and now, you know, I pour my effort and time into Saracens.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode, and pardon the interruption. This is an advertisement for BetterHelp Therapy Online. Getting to know yourself can be a lifelong process, especially because we're always growing and changing. I know the last few years have been a period of reflection and resetting for a lot of people, myself included. As regular listeners will know, I embraced a lot of new things into my life, including cold water therapy and long distance running. Therapy, in whatever form, is all about deepening your self-awareness and understanding. Because sometimes we don't know what we want or why we react the way we do until we talk through things. Personally, the last few years have seen, for the very first time, me struggling with my mental health. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to talk to people who can help. BetterHelp connects you with a therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery from wherever you are. I feel like I've changed a lot in the last few years, and I know that I've really grown as a person because I've gotten to know myself better. I've really invested the time to do this, and I know I'll never stop learning. Don't be afraid to open up and ask for help. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a therapist, and switching therapists anytime for no additional charge. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their very first month at betterhelp.com/justdoit. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/justdoit. Now, back to this week's episode.
So Alex, I'd like to ask you a question from a former teammate and a recent guest on the show, Mr. George Cruz, who said, "Ask Alex why he wouldn't leave my house for 3 days dressed in full Saracens kit and why every year he posts my house address on Twitter saying there's a house party to the point that people are turning up at my house with full crates of beer."
Yeah, it's a true story for once. George has not lied for once there. But say every year, there's been a few years that I have posted his address. George is someone who loves to stitch people up, but loves a wind up the whole time. I don't know why, but when me and Chris Ashton, me and McAvoy and Pola get together, like there's a lot of other boys, like he makes enemies, George. And there's a lot of boys who sort of are very eager to get him back after we've sort of won a trophy or the end of the season. And there's been a few times when I may have posted his address. Famously, on the third day of my bum bag full kit kind of piss up, which I'm a lot more famous for than rugby.
There's a lot of that online, by the way.
Yeah, it's amazing. You have sort of 17 years of rugby, 20 odd caps for England, a few hundred cups, but no one really cares. I just love the fact that you get pissed in a bum bag. I mean, how British? You're more famous for being an alcoholic than a rugby player. But yeah, including that day where I managed to get some of the team over to George's. I was staying at George's house, hadn't quite made it home. And George went to a physio and I texted a few of the lads saying, "Why don't you come over and have a house party at George's?" So and then it got on the group and then George gets home and goes, "Hang on a minute, what's this about?" As we're all drinking beers in his living room with his cleaner, who hadn't done any work. And then next thing we know, we're in there for the day and we posted the address a few times. And very sad on this one, but we went to the pub at about 4 o'clock. A little crawl, as you do on the third day, and sadly about 4:30, 4:45, two lads turned up with a crate of beer, knocked on the door, and George's housemate was there, who wasn't a rugby player, and he was like, "Can I help you?" And they're like, "We're here for the house party, that's good." And he was like, "Oh, actually quite sorry for you," but he left about half an hour ago, and I would have welcomed them in with open arms, never got their names.
Believe you.
I think it would be a great story, a few people joining us. So yeah, George used to get quite upset, threatened to, if he got burgled or anything got robbed, that I'd have to pay for anything that got robbed when he was away and all that stuff. He got quite upset about it, very sensitive. And clearly he's not let it go, even though that was in 2019. So he probably needs to get over it. Yeah.
It's interesting because everybody that I've mentioned that your upcoming guest on the show has great player. Ask him about 3 days.
Honestly, it's one of those perfect storms. I hadn't planned it or thought about it. I didn't even post anything on social media. It's just all the boys putting stuff up. So
right.
It wasn't like I was self-publicising myself. I just want to be quite clear on that. But I guess it was that perfect storm of you win the European Cup. You don't really get insight probably into what the players are up to much. And then I'd been named European Player of the Year. And I guess seeing the European Player of the Year in his kit with a fanny pack, his gum shoe in his pocket, in his boots 3 days later, with a Guinness in hand, is people are like, "Bloody hell, he's really going for it still." And yeah, people were a bit shocked, really. And certainly for me, when I woke up on Tuesday morning, I'd run out of battery, I think, Monday night, and I wasn't checking it. I woke up on Tuesday morning, charged my phone, and my phone was kicking off. And I'm gone, what the hell have I done? This isn't good. Automatically thought the worst of myself, thought I've done something bad here, and then had to sort of go through a few of them, and it was all very positive of, can anyone let me know if Alex Good's still alive, or how good, yeah. Is Alex Good still going? Can we get some report? And I was like, okay, this seems to be positive. And yeah, my girlfriend at the time works in the music industry. She thought I was a bit cool after that. I think she thought I was a bit square before that, maybe. And she's like, oh yeah, he likes a drink. Fair enough. He's a bit more about him.
Personality.
Yeah, no, she was not a boring rug player or something like that. I was like, oh, thanks.
Oh, so
yeah,
man.
Help me out there.
That's funny. And like George, you played out in Japan for a while with Saracens, while Saracens were in the championship. He comes back and he retires. Were you surprised he retired when he did?
Yes and no. I mean, he achieved everything he wanted to achieve. I know that it's quite hard, I think, especially for forwards when you go out to Japan, a lot of running, quite hard, can't keep that body sort of mass. The physicality of the European game is quite hard to go back to, I think. And also, where was his motivation at the time? He'd had a great time in Japan, he'd won, he'd enjoyed it, and I think he was ready to move to his next chapter. So although he had probably some incredible offers, I think he was just like, my motivation isn't there. And he had prepared himself for that next step. And with 4 or 5, he had a brilliant, exciting company to get involved with. And I know that his partner, Dom Day, had been sort of, probably, I don't know this bit, but doing a lot, working full time in the company. And George probably felt, you know, it's my turn to really get stuck in.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. And if not now, when? And again, this is all me sort of guessing. He could have kept playing. He's a brilliant player, very in demand. But he sort of made that move and making a huge success of it. So credit to him.
Yeah. And with the recent collapses we've seen with like Wasps and Worcester, Welsh players threatening to strike, how much thought do you give to life after the game, or life still in the game, if that's something that you've entertained as well?
I think with all those things, you always a little bit, I always sort of cherish the time I've had. You never know when it can end through injury and all that. So you have to appreciate the time you have had out there and the memories that I've got. And I'm extremely lucky. Well, people say, oh, you know, are you not annoyed you haven't played more for England? Well, of course you'd love to do that, but I've had a lot from this game. I mean, you know, from winning medals to trips away as a team, you know, some of the best times of my life have been with my teammates on a ski slope or in Miami or in Cape Town. You know, those opportunities aren't happening if I'm working as a dustbin man, probably. But yeah, those are incredible memories and ones that'll stay with me for the rest of my life. So in that regard, just cherish what I have had, really, and still doing. Whether it was because of Wasps and Worcester and everything else going on, doesn't change the fact that you can't beat Father Time, and I'm getting older and older, and there aren't too many older players at my age playing. I know I played a back line that was pretty old the other day, but you know, to be still playing at a top club like Saracens, competing in Europe and in the Premiership, and you know, at the highest level, it is tough and it's intense, and hopefully I can keep doing that and enjoying it, but that won't last forever, I guess.
And what interests do you have outside of the game if you get the time to do stuff?
I had more time before I had a son, probably. But no, outside of rugby, I've always been pretty active, from being an ambassador for two charities, or a trustee in one charity, ambassador for the other, Matt Hampson, and Brick by Brick, which is a charity that builds schools and provides teachers in Malawi. My mum set up. So very active with those. Also, always been involved in property, so renting out properties, development there, just always keeping busy. And businesses, little businesses here and there, which there's no point mentioning here, but always been pretty active and involved in keeping myself busy. I'm not very good at sort of sitting still, so I like to stay involved with different things, keep my mind going, got my degree. And so, yeah, I'm still working out what my life after rugby choice or choices will be, but I've luckily kept myself busy enough that there's little things here and there that I can get my teeth into at the moment and try and work towards, one of those maybe being a longer term project in the long run. So
okay.
I don't know what that is. And it's always been life after rugby. I've been quite vague there. I get it, but I don't have the answer. And
okay.
It's my biggest fear. Don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here thinking it will work out. I've always been most fearful of life after rugby and having something to get up for in the morning and a reason to get up in the morning. And that drives me on to find it. And you know, to the point where I'm talking to a psychologist at the moment about it, or a psychiatrist, whichever way you look at it, to try and work out why that problem feels so big. Not what it is they're going to give me the answer as to what I'm going to go into, but why I get anxiety and fear and worry about life after rugby. And everyone always says, oh, you'll be fine, you got this,
yeah, but
you know, but it's my worry, it's my fear, and it's me who wants to, you know, be a success. And part of the probably downside of being relatively successful at rugby is that you're competitive and you want to do well and you want to be successful at everything you do. And it isn't quite as easy as that, but you put pressure on yourself. And I said this to my fiance, I was like, you know, she can tell me, or people can tell me, or you don't have to worry, it'll work itself out, or, you know, there's no pressure from us stuff. But naturally, I put pressure on myself to be successful, because it's the same what I do in rugby. I'm pressuring myself to do well because I want to do well. I don't want to let anyone down or be rubbish. And that's the same in everything we do. You can't change. You can't switch that off one day. So that's just how I look at it. And hopefully that'll help me make the problem slightly smaller and I'll work towards things. And in the meantime, for anxiety, this little doggy is fantastic for that. So
I've also heard of this CBD company. You can say it's this.
One, it'd be lovely to get any freebie from them. It'd be lovely. But I haven't gone down the CBD route. Maybe I probably should. But I don't really trust what George puts in there. No, I'm joking. Their products are actually phenomenal. And I've taken a humongous
amount of
multivits, yes, probiotics, fish oils, the lot. And I'm still playing. If that's not a sign, because turns out all I'm working on is Guinness, a bum bag, and then 4 or 5 tablets. So that's a recipe there.
Fantastic.
I should be the face of the product now.
And what does your fiance say to you when you do, like, you know, have these worries about life after rugby?
She's amazing, Lucy. She's part of the biggest support she gives me, is just be able to talk about it, really. I think as you get older, a lot of probably my ways would keep a lot in for myself and not worry other people about stuff, or I don't want to make it a big issue for you. But actually with her, we're very good at sort of hopefully talking about this or that, or this worry or that worry. And I find it a huge help. And she can't give me the answer.
No.
But she can be there and support me and help and you know, be as helpful as she can be. And she understands it much more now. It is quite hard for professional players to go from something you do and institutionalized and doing for, in my case, by the time I finished, maybe 20 years, to then reinvent yourself. And of course, everyone else, you go, oh, that's really exciting. And it can be when you get to that stage, but there's, as I said, I think before this interview, there's maybe 2 or 3 jobs or 18 months or 2 years of working things out and going through some quite tough times and not being around your best mates in your change room and doing what you love forever and trying to find that exciting route. And that's quite tough. And there's an ego to that as well, of being someone known as something and being good at that to then not being that at all. And there's challenges all around, really. So that's the kind of way of, you know, that's what you're trying to navigate.
And is it something that's talked about amongst teammates, or is that very different because you've got people at such opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to careers?
It's the thing, you just don't say, you don't really ask, really, in rugby. Some people, you know, they've got a business and it's like, oh, you're going to do that when you're done. But not until you really get to that last bit and you say, right, I'm going to retire. People go, oh, what are you going to do then? But I don't think anyone on my team has really asked me, what are you going to do after rugby? And I'm obviously quite busy. So I think a lot of them assume I'll be all right, which is the worst thing. Put more pressure on myself. But yeah, I think in rugby, you don't tend to ask people about it, because you know deep down, if you don't know, like if you're a teammate and you're like, I don't know what to do after rugby, I'm not going to ask him what he's going to do after rugby, because that might put him in a difficult spot. I don't know. So it's quite a difficult one, really. And maybe other people have the same fear and the same worries as well, because ultimately you're doing your hobby for a living. Nearly all people in rugby, you start out because they love rugby and they get to do it as a job. And of course, there are bits they don't love, like every job, but it's pretty amazing when you go out there and you play in a, you know, premiership final in front of 85,000 people, you play for your country in front of 85,000 people. You're never going to replicate that in a job. So you've got to not try and do that. And two, finding something that gives you stimulation of some kind is that challenge.
And I think it's exciting to think about what the next chapter could be, because traditionally, you know, going back however many years, people had one career, whether you become a policeman, a doctor, a lawyer, you know, things that friends of mine have done, and that's it. Whereas these days, it's far more accepted to reinvent yourself. Like, you know, I've done myself a number of times, whereas my brother's been a lawyer, you know, his entire life, and friends who are policemen, done it their entire lives, and now they're just like that. hate my job, but I'm now like 50 something.
Yeah.
What am I going to do now? But you just think, you're also a long time retired. And I know I blew my knee out when I was 30. And it's funny, the thing I miss the most isn't necessarily the games, not that I remotely played at a standard union, but is the camaraderie of just being in the dressing room, like before and after games. And at the time, I decided not to come back from that. For, you know, whatever, I just met my girlfriend, now wife, mother of my kids. And it's just that I was playing for two teams a week, training, you know, all the time. And I was really passionate about it. But just at that time in your life, when you're at that certain age, it was like, I let that go. And then a couple of years go by and you're like, I really miss that. And then it's like, can't be asked. I try to get into touch rugby, and that was not remotely similar to me.
It's hard. And you get such contrasting advice, because there's so many people who go, play as long as you can. Tell you what, you're a long time retired.
Yeah.
And you hear that. But I think you'll know, like for me, when I just can't have any influence in a game, or everything is a struggle from training to games to, and you've got no motivation to go in there and do your weights or to do your rehab or to do, you know, to stretch, to get ready, and you're like just coasting along really. And I'll never be able to do that at Saracen. So no. As soon as I get to that point where I'm like, no, I can't do that. That spark or that competitive nature of me in the games or in training isn't there, I'll know to go, my time's up. Mm. Like, I'm not going to hang around and just hold pads and, you know, sit on the physio bed. I'm either involved or I'm not here. So, and that's the decision and the mindset I have to keep looking at and checking in on and see where I'm at.
And what do you like put longevity down to? Because you say there's not many other players, you know, playing past the age you're at, and you'll see like an Alan Wynne Jones, who I think like 37 coming up to 38 and playing in a hard position. And then you look at, like, I'm super passionate American football fan, and you look at a Tom Brady, and they're like clearly an alien, because how could you keep playing a you know, contact sport when you're four, and getting hit when a lot of the time you're unprotected.
Well, Tom Brady's, the game has changed in NFL. He's not getting hit too much these days.
No, the way they protect the quarterback.
But for him to be so mentally sharp is so impressive. Now, I haven't been having avocado ice cream like him or everything else. But no, I think obviously medical science has helped a lot of players, because there are people like, you know, Chris Ashton, you know, Richard Wigglesworth played older. Yeah. It tends to be people who probably didn't, you know, Alan Wynne Jones is defined logic, really. I mean, yeah, to be in that kind of contact zone and keep going, and even the mental strength to come back from shoulder surgeries and this again and again, like, he must love it, and fair play to him. I think what I put it down to, running away and kicking the ball a lot before anyone tackles me is helpful. Avoiding contact, which sounds like I'm a chicken, or very smart. Yeah. Like, the game of rugby is evasive, run into space. Why run at someone like a Vuna Polo, who's massive and going to eat me alive, when I could run to the side of them and have a fighting chance? Yeah. You know, think about it that way. But yeah, I think I do love the game. So mentally, I love training, I love competing, I love coming at pre-season and trying to be the fittest every year still, and, you know, that drives me on to still be that. And then, probably contrary to my drinking antics, I do try and look after myself quite well, and I'm not saying I'm a monk and the most professional, but, you know, there's a reason why I probably played 350 games. I have looked after myself relatively well. I train hard and love being out there, really, and if you've got that passion, as I go back to, then it does help.
And notice, like, you've obviously been captain many times, but the last couple of weeks you kept in Saris as well. Do you prepare any differently for that?
Probably not now. I think maybe 2 years ago, I thought a bit more worry and, well, just worries really, and anxiety of making sure, you know, everyone's in the right place. And ultimately, whether I'm captain or not captain, you want everyone to play well and you want to help them do that. It's probably a limit. I probably stop thinking, oh, well, I can't control everything. So fundamentally, get your role right, play well, and lead by that example. And that goes a long way to helping everyone else. And then keeping the messaging quite simple for people, really. I think when you try and be something you're not or overcomplicate things, it never really works. So, yeah. But again, you know, there's people at the club who are incredibly helpful in the team. You know, I'm not the only one talking. There's plenty of people who talk. And, you know, there's probably no need for me to tell everyone to go run up there and smash into people and whack people when I'm playing at fullback and dancing around the place, you know. It's better if that comes from a Billy Vunipola or someone in the front line. So it's about being clear in my messaging of what I'm there to do and help. And as a leader, I'm there to help tactically and put us in the right places the whole time, while there are other people to lead physically.
And interested to know the mindset like when you go from your club, you play internationally, you come back, and then you end up with yourself like a Beanie Vanapola. You're no longer in the England setup, but you're playing for the club and you've got internationals going away. How does the mindset shift?
I don't think it shifts too much in that regard. It's the next cab on the rank, really. These other guys who get an opportunity and they probably need a bit more nurturing, a bit more understanding. So, you know, if there's a front row of previously, you know, Vincent Cott, Jamie George, Maka Vanapola, and you've got Nick Azikwe, Mauro Itoje, if they aren't putting their weight on something, you can be a bit like, no, you've got to do more of that. But a young prop or young hooker in Theo Dan or, you know, something like that, they make mistakes. Like, don't worry. Your intent was right. It's a small mistake. Don't worry, next one, to get the next one. So then you're a bit more like get behind them. And I'm not saying that's a very simple, hard and fast rule, but with the younger group, it's about making sure that their actions, like their intent and their work ethic and the fundamentals or the foundations, you want to call it, are there. Drop balls, miss passes. Like, that's not because they're not trying. So there's no point berating them for that. It's about getting behind them and going, well, the right option was there, doing the right thing. It just didn't quite work. So don't worry about it. Next job. And it's that kind of get behind them and then not to go, oh, I'm going to, you know, not do anything now. I don't want the ball in case I drop it. I don't want to do a pass because I don't want to make a mistake. Or they go inside themselves. You want to keep bringing their intensity and how well they're doing and just help them along.
I think that's why Dan Bigger copped a load of flack for Wales when he like berated Rio Dyer for flinging a pass at him, I think in the second international game. You know, he copped a load of flack on that for doing that. And he was probably, you know, rush of blood, didn't think about it in the moment, who he's addressing it to, but it's all a bit public, I suppose, isn't it? Really?
Well, it is. And a lot of time that person knows they've made a mistake, yeah, really, and they feel great about it. If he does it four times in a row, you probably rightly get annoyed. But, yeah, you know, as I said, have they shown the intent to work hard, to bust a gut, to be physical, all the right intent, then you can work with that and nurture the other bits, and that's all you really ask.
And finish up, interested now, you kind of touched on or mentioned a few times the success of Saracens.
I haven't. I don't know about that, but someone else maybe in the room. George mentioned it.
But where do you put that down to? Is there a certain DNA? And I remember, you know, my experience is being at Bath and seeing them win everything every single year again back in, you know, the 90s. But they've struggled massively to replicate that success despite considerable investment, et cetera, and having a really good squad of players there this season and a new coach, et cetera. But yours has been ingrained for many, many years. But you've again, longevity of success at club level. But what do you kind of put those down to? Is there a couple of things?
I think Brendan Venter and Edward Griffiths, when they first came in, revolutionised the side, really, honestly, and changed everything. I don't know if there are any other coaches or anyone else could have done that because it took such a big overhaul. Like, it was a failing organisation. And they were brave enough to go, we're going to get rid of your best players. The highest paid best players, they got rid of them. We brought in journeymen, some workman-like players, some Division One players, and everyone was like, Saracens are going to be relegated, you know? We went and won the first 10 games, like stupid. And it was that sort of the ending of it. But what it was that Brendan Venter came in and just really knuckled, sort of went deep into the fundamentals and the foundations and said, look, you know, everyone gets paid money. Everyone, no one is doing it really for the money, otherwise you'd be a banker or something like that, you know? He tried to tap into something a bit deeper as to a reason for why you'll work harder than the opposition team, you know, why you won't let your teammates down. And he basically fostered this huge work ethic, massive physicality and a togetherness. And that first year at the start, it wasn't pretty at all. We kicked the leather off it and we just worked so hard and we whacked people and we shocked people. And we realized that actually, you know, you can get, if you get 15 players going the same direction, working incredibly hard for something, then that's very powerful. And that was the sort of change of, we want players who are going to work incredibly hard as opposed to the ones who are incredibly talented, because we broke it down into effort error, skill error. A skill error is drop pass, sort of mentioned it before, bad kick, missed tackle. And Brendan said, that's on me as a coach. I need to upskill you as a player, help you in that. But if you don't work back quick enough, you don't get off the floor quick enough, you don't kick chase quick enough, you never play for my team. And he broke it down quite simple. If you work really, really hard, you'll play. If you don't, then... And actually, off the back of that, those hard-working players are probably the ones who are doing more extras to get better at passing, to get better at tackling. are great for the environment and great for the team, and everyone respects them hugely for their effort, and that's what we had. What made us really successful though was having those foundations and then having a core group of players who played a lot together, developed a lot together, and probably led the group more so than the coaches to an extent to that success. And you had people from myself, Brad Barrett, Owen Farrell, Richard Wigglesworth, Peter Vinopola, Maro George, Mako, Jamie George, like, who played so much rugby together, and a lot of those guys sort of led how our standards were, led what we wanted to be as a club, how we wanted to improve. And it's why we probably had that success over a sustained period, because we're guys who are never happy, you know, judging ourselves on other teams. It's our standards and how can we improve each week? Now we've won the Cup, next year we want to win it again, we want to win the European Cup. And you keep building and building. And it's like a relentless intensity and thirst, and it's tough. But it's what's probably, you know, helped us out massively, and having those big leaders made us successful over such a long period.
And it's quite often that those successful organisations have, you know, taken the directive and, you know, absorbed it, but they take it on themselves, as you say. And there's, whether it's a team or an organisation, you have key figures kind of driving that through to the rest of it, so everybody buys into it.
I think as well, it's often spoken about how, oh, it's team-led and players want to take control and stuff like that. It's a lot harder than people realize. Like, it means you've got to put time and effort into thinking about how we can get better, thinking about meetings, thinking about looking at videos, thinking about the whole group. Like, it's not as easy as going, oh, players do it. Oh, I think we should do this today and that. Like, you have to put time and effort and thought into that. And that's a bit people don't quite grasp, I think. They go, oh, players let, you know, One, it takes a group who know each other really well, cohesion, be a huge part of that. So you can have those honest conversations. But two, you've got to put time and effort into it. And that makes, upon me, a big difference.
Right, let's finish up. Little quickfire rounds. Best player you've ever played with?
Oh, this is too hard.
It's a difficult one.
I'm actually going to exclude anyone from Saracens on this.
Okay.
And say Thierry Doucetoile, to play with him in the Barbarians.
Okay.
He was an incredible player. Not necessarily when we were playing the Barbarians, he was retiring then, but watching him, he was an incredible player.
Best player you played against?
Israel Folau.
Okay.
As a 15.
Really?
There were points where you couldn't defend him. Like crossfield kicks, running lines. For not a great Australian side, he was freakishly good.
And player who never lived up to their potential.
Horrible thing to say about anyone.
I just going to what George named somebody who was at Saracens.
Did he?
Who was Welsh.
Oh, Gavin Henson.
Yeah.
Well, I think a bit missed. I don't think he was as good as everyone said he was. I think he had a couple of good games. Everyone, he's the best centre ever. And I don't think he was.
Yeah.
I never saw that, but I think he lived up to his potential. I don't know. There's a guy I went to school with called Nick Waller, who he had potential because he had 3 knee operations, but I think he would have played at least England sevens, if not played Premiership rugby at a good level. So
I was going to follow up was there anyone at school that you remember seeing just thinking, wow, they're the most talented person in the world, and then literally nothing?
We played together from the age of 10 to 18 twice a week, trained 3 or 4 times a week forever, and we had a brilliant understanding, and he was an exceptional player. Him or someone like another guy from school called Eddie Brown, who was on the verge, would have played, he was in Eastern Counties, would have played London South East, would have started for England under 16s. He was that good. And he did his ACL in the just before the trials for London South East. And, you know, he wasn't at a private school and like that. His physio eventually came through a year later, but he'd missed his shot. And then,
wow.
Wasn't really able to get into England 18s like that because he wasn't at a good enough club or school to help nurture him. And he was an exceptional talent. He would have been very good. So those two players are the two I played with who really would have been the ones.
And most annoying player, I find it usually a scrum half, but up to you.
Except in this way, is Chris Ashton. He's a knobhead. Quote me on that. And it says a lot about me because he's one of my good mates.
Right.
But he is annoying, yeah. Right, little pigeon.
And bum bag or fanny pack?
Bum bag, because I think I'll probably get cancelled for saying fanny pack these days.
That looks good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, can I encourage you to follow the show by clicking the plus button in the top right-hand corner of your screen if you're listening by Apple Podcasts, or the follow button on Spotify and other platforms. It means you'll be the first to be notified whenever a new episode goes live. Did you know that nearly half of podcast listeners find a show through searching online? It's
if you've gotten any value at all, please share this episode with one or more of your friends and make it easy for them to find a podcast you think they'll enjoy. If you'd like to join the Screw It, Just Do It community, go to podpreneur.co.uk/get in touch to sign up to our weekly newsletter and free resources. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch.